Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor.
Today, we're taking on something pretty substantial. We're doing an exhaustive, really comprehensive deep dive into the weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal for Saturday, October 18th, 2025.
Yeah, it's quite the stack of material. We've got everything in here: market jitters, global politics, some really surprising political moves, AI's future. It's all in this one paper.
And our mission, as always, is to really cut through all that noise for you. We want to distill every key article, give you, our listener, that immediate, deep understanding.
Exactly. We're going to connect the dots, look at the global economy, major policy shifts happening right now, and you know those critical societal changes that this snapshot in time reveals.
So we have to start where the action is, right? The markets. If things felt a bit choppy, maybe, this past week you weren't imagining it. That recent quiet spell, that sort of calm we had, it's officially done. Shattered, really. Wall Street seems to be bracing for, well, a serious return to turbulence.
Yeah, that quiet stretch we saw through the summer, that relative peace, it definitely ended with a bang. You can feel the foundation rattling. Investors are clearly positioning for some real stress ahead.
And the paper points to this laundry list of worries, as one source put it. What's on that list that spooked the trader so much?
Well, there are three main things driving the fear, according to the journal. First, the trade war seems to be heating up again, sharply.
Oh.
Second, those old worries about loan losses at regional banks. They're back.
Ah, okay. Not gone then.
Not gone at all. And third, maybe the biggest one systemically, there's this growing anxiety about the AI stock run-up. You know, has it gone too far too fast?
Right. And we have a number for that fear, don't we? The VIX, the SIBO Volatility Index.
That's the one, the fear gauge.
It spiked pretty dramatically. The report says it hit 28.99 midday Friday. That's its highest point since, what, late April?
Exactly. And when the VIX jumps like that, it basically means traders are expecting some really wild, unpredictable stock swings over the next month or so.
But it's not just the level, 28.99, that's concerning, is it? You mentioned something about the options trading.
Yeah, this is what's really striking, I think. It's not just high volatility they're expecting. It's the level of catastrophe some are betting on. The data from SIBO Global Markets shows investors are piling into options contracts.
Okay.
That only pay out if the VIX surges way, way higher. We're talking bets on it hitting 47.5 or even 50.
50? For listeners who maybe don't follow the VIX that closely, what does a bet like that actually mean, hitting 50?
It means they're not just preparing for a market correction, like a 10% drop. They're positioning for a full-blown crisis.
Wow.
When the VIX gets into the mid to high 40s, historically, that's associated with extreme systemic market stress. Think peak pandemic fear, think the 2008 financial meltdown.
So these traders aren't just hedging their bets slightly, they're genuinely anticipating severe turbulence.
It seems that way for some. Jordan Rizzuto, he's the CIO at Gamma Road Capital Partners, he summed it up well. He said, and I'm quoting here, "The laundry list of worries is actually increasing."
Okay.
Which, you know, points towards volatility staying high for a while.
And yet, here's the weird part, the paradox. Despite this massive spike in fear, the actual stock market indexes, the S&P 500, the Dow, the NASDAQ, they all finished the week higher. The S&P was up 1.8%.
Right.
How does that work? If the fear is so high, why are the indexes climbing?
It's a great question, and it shows the tension in the market right now. It suggests that the underlying economic picture, maybe boosted by some strong earnings reports we should talk about, is fighting back against those specific fear triggers. The short-term fear gauge, the VIX, is pricing in that risk, but the bigger economic engines, especially big tech and the major banks, showed some resilience this week.
So that difference itself is fueling the uncertainty. Is it a buying opportunity or the calm before a storm?
Exactly. That's the million-dollar question, or maybe trillion-dollar question, facing investors right now. Oh, so let's dig into that first trigger you mentioned, the trade war. The market seemed to swing back and forth on this. President Trump actually seemed to calm things down a bit on Friday afternoon. He did, temporarily. He made comments suggesting that his proposed 100% additional tariffs on Chinese goods were, in his words, not sustainable.
And that gave the market a boost.
Yeah, it offered a moment of hope, maybe a sign that the really aggressive rhetoric might ease up. But the bigger picture the journal paints is more complicated.
How so?
Well, behind the scenes, the administration seems to be quietly, maybe strategically, walking back some of those broad reciprocal tariffs that have been a signature policy.
Walking them back.
Yeah, they've apparently exempted dozens of products already.
Okay.
And they're offering to carve out hundreds more. Everything from farm goods to specific airplane parts, but only for countries that strike specific trade deals with the U.S.
Okay, so it's not a blanket reduction. It's targeted. What's the thinking behind lowering duties on some things but not others?
It seems like a dose of pragmatism, maybe. They're recognizing that hitting everything with tariffs, well, it hurts American consumers and businesses too, especially when it's stuff the U.S. just doesn't make domestically.
Right.
The journal highlights this specific list called Annex 3. That seems to be the core of this new approach, and it targets products that, quote, cannot be grown, mined, or naturally produced in the United States.
Like what kinds of products?
Think coffee, cocoa, certain unpatented drug ingredients, stuff we have to import. The logic seems to be, if we can't make it here anyway, why are we taxing it so heavily?
That makes sense from a consumer perspective, but you mentioned strategic implications too, especially with the courts involved.
Absolutely. This policy shift is happening right before a really crucial Supreme Court hearing. It's scheduled for early November, and it's about those very reciprocal tariffs.
And what could happen there?
Well, if the administration loses the case, the court could force them to pay back potentially billions of dollars in tariffs already collected from importers.
Oh, okay.
So these new carve-outs, this Annex Third list, it looks a lot like a legal hedge. It's a way to reduce their potential liability if the Supreme Court rules against them. It's kind of like damage control dressed up as trade strategy.
A classic Washington two-step. But while they're easing up on some tariffs, they're also using a different tool more aggressively, Section 232.
That's right. Section 232 of that old 1962 Trade Expansion Act. That's the one based on national security claims.
And what are they doing with that?
They just announced pretty significant new tariffs using Section 232. It's 25% on trucks and truck parts and 10% on buses. Those kick in November 1st.
Okay, so new tariffs there.
But, and here's the nuance. At the same time, they expanded a tariff relief program specifically for automakers. This lets car companies apply for credits to offset some of the tariff costs on parts, and they extended that program out to 2030.
So hitting trucks and buses hard, but giving automakers a bit more breathing room.
Exactly. It shows this very targeted, almost surgical approach, protecting some domestic industries, softening the blow for others. It's definitely not as simple across-the-board policy anymore.
Okay. Shifting from trade friction to the health of the U.S. financial system, the market jitters were also fueled by a really mixed picture from the banks, right?
Very mixed. On the one hand, you had those blockbuster earnings you alluded to earlier. JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, they reported really strong numbers.
Which should have calmed fears about a slowdown.
You'd think so. It definitely tempered those fears. It suggested the biggest players in the banking sector are still pretty resilient.
But there's always a but, isn't there?
There usually is. The but came from the regional banking sector. That's been the weak spot for the past year or so. Zions Bancorp announced a big loss.
What was that tied to?
Specifically tied to fraud accusations against some of their borrowers. And even though it's just one bank, coming after the strong results from the giants, it was enough to reignite all those dormant worries about the smaller regional banks.
So it's a reminder that those localized risks haven't just disappeared.
Precisely. And the market worries, you know, is the Zions loss just the tip of the iceberg? Are there broader issues with credit quality or internal controls bubbling under the surface at other smaller banks? Banks that don't have that too-big-to-fail safety net.
So how should investors weigh that? One regional bank faltering versus massive profits from the giants?
It really highlights how sensitive the market is to systemic risk perception right now. Even a single failure like Zions can trigger broader fears. And the reaction was immediate.
Where'd the money go?
Straight into the classic safe havens. We saw big inflows into utilities, healthcare, consumer staples, the sectors known for stable businesses, and importantly, hefty dividends.
And the bond market reacted too.
Textbook flight to safety. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note dropped, getting close to its lows for the year. That's a classic sign. Investors are seeking safety over risk.
And gold. That usually does well in uncertain times.
Spectacularly well this week. Gold futures soared 5.4%. That was their best weekly gain since May.
Wow.
Yeah, gold acting exactly like the ultimate hedge against uncertainty that it's supposed to be.
And on the other side of the coin, the riskier stuff.
Took a beating. Bitcoin, for example, fell 8.7% last week. That was its worst week since February.
So a clear move away from risk.
Definitely. And it echoes that warning from Jordan Rizzuto we mentioned earlier. He drew comparisons between the high valuations and concentrated gains in big tech now and the dot-com bubble back in the late 90s. He was careful, you know, saying history might not repeat exactly, but his words, It certainly rhymes.
Okay, so it's clear the economy is in a really volatile state, reacting to tariffs, bank worries, AI froth. But the turbulence isn't just financial, is it? The world of policy, legal fights, political maneuvers in Washington seems just as active, maybe even more so.
It really does feel like the anxiety in the markets is mirrored in the political system. The government machinery keeps grinding away, even with disruptions like the ongoing shutdown.
Right, the shutdown. And we're seeing the immediate human cost of that in the unemployment numbers.
Yeah, the data is stark. Initial unemployment claims filed by federal workers jumped dramatically last week. Over 7,200 claims filed.
Compared to what, normally?
Compared to just under 600 the week before the shutdown started on October 1st. So a massive increase.
And that's mostly furloughed workers.
Mostly furloughed workers, yes. But there's a really crucial legal and financial angle here that's probably driving some of those claims.
Oh, shiz.
The uncertainty around back pay. There was a law passed in 2019 that guaranteed federal workers would get paid retroactively once a shutdown ends.
Okay, I remember that.
But the current administration is actually challenging that law. They're arguing it might not apply this time.
So even if these workers expect to get paid eventually, they might not, or at least not automatically.
Exactly. There's uncertainty. And they can't afford to wait months for a legal battle to play out while they have bills to pay now.
So they're filing for unemployment even if they hope to get back pay later.
Precisely. Especially since this past pay period was the first one where furloughed workers got absolutely nothing, not even a partial paycheck. The longer that challenge to the 2019 law continues, the higher those claims are likely to go. It adds economic drag and obviously a lot of personal stress for those families.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, beyond the shutdown, the administration made some other high-profile moves this week related to legal matters and appointments. It feels as there's a focus on settling old scores, maybe revisiting past fights.
That's certainly one interpretation. The most immediate headline-grabbing move was President Trump commuting the sentence of former Representative George Santos.
Right, Santos. He just started his sentence in July, didn't he? After pleading guilty to wire fraud, identity theft?
That's him. And the president announced the commutation on social media, claiming Santos had been, quote, horribly mistreated in solitary confinement.
The speed of that, just a few months into his sentence,
yeah. It
certainly sends a message. Given Santos's very well-documented history of fabrications and his expulsion from the House.
It does reinforce a certain narrative. And then on the appointment side, there's another move that signals a clear focus on the 2020 election.
Who's this?
Kurt Olson. He was a lawyer for the Trump campaign back then, one who really aggressively pushed claims of widespread voter fraud.
Okay.
He's now joined the administration. Officially, he's a special government employee for a temporary period, 130 days.
130 days? That sounds very specific. What's he supposed to be doing?
Well, according to people familiar with the plan, his agenda is pretty specific. And potentially quite controversial.
Like what?
Things like examining election machines, requesting classified or proprietary information about the 2020 election from intelligence agencies.
Wow.
And also, reportedly, working to identify and potentially remove government employees he sees as disloyal to the president.
So bringing someone who pushed the stolen election narrative inside the government to investigate the election and personnel loyalty.
Essentially, yes. With direct access to the Oval Office. It looks like an effort to institutionalize those challenges to the 2020 results. One former official quoted in the journal said, this kind of effort has already changed the factual history of that event in a lot of people's minds.
That environment of revisiting past grievances seems to be affecting others, too. John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, was indicted this week.
That's right. Indicted for allegedly mishandling classified information related to his memoir, The Room Where It Happened.
What's the specific charge?
The prosecution claims he shared over 1,000 pages of diary-like notes containing highly classified material with his wife and daughter, neither of whom had security clearance, while he was writing the book. So the core issue is improper sharing of sensitive info.
But Bolton's defense is that this is purely political payback, right?
Yeah,
because he criticized Trump in the book.
Exactly. He's arguing he followed the White House review process, and this is just retribution. He even quoted Stalin's police chief. You show me the man and I'll show you the crime. Strong words. But do legal experts see it that way?
The journal spoke to some who draw a distinction. They acknowledge other Trump administration pursuits of critics might have been on, quote, shakier legal footing.
Okay.
But the Bolton case seems to have emerged from a more traditional, longer investigation into handling classified materials. So while the political context is impossible to ignore, some career prosecutors apparently see this specific case as having more solid footing legally. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Away from the White House, but still looking at political and financial agendas, there's a fascinating deep dive in the Journal about the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, and their nominee for New York mayor, Zoran Mamdani.
Yeah, this is really important for understanding where a significant part of the American left is heading ideologically.
Yeah.
The DSA today is, well, it's very different from its origins with people like Michael Harrington.
How so? What does their platform look like now?
The national platform that Mamdani represents, it's pretty aggressive, pretty radical by mainstream standards.
Give us a sense.
Okay, well, it supports abolishing the police, abolishing prisons, abolishing border enforcement entirely.
Wow, okay.
It also calls for nationalizing huge swaths of the economy, railroads, utilities, the financial sector. And they even advocate for a second constitutional convention to basically rewrite the country's fundamental structure.
Does Mamdani explicitly endorse all of that?
He's apparently been a bit evasive on endorsing the entire national platform directly. But his specific stances, especially on issues like Israel, are very clear and aligned with that broader DSA perspective.
What's his stance on Israel?
He's shown strong interest in the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, sanctions. And significantly, right after the October 7th attacks last year, his statement denounced Netanyahu's declaration of war, but didn't explicitly mention Hamas or the victims. It focused more on the broader conflict dynamics.
And his position became even clearer recently.
It did. During the ceasefire announcement this week, he put out a statement that essentially equated the return of Israeli hostages held by Hamas with the release of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel.
Equated them.
Effectively, yes. And when he was pushed in a debate, should Hamas unilaterally disarm, he initially dodged the question for several days.
Before saying what? Before eventually offering a very carefully worded statement. Of course, I believe that they should lay down their arms. The Journal suggests this careful positioning reflects the DSA's deeper ideological view, seeing themselves as building a revolutionary Marxist-Leninist movement aimed at eventually replacing the Democratic Party. It really shows the high stakes in these local races and the deep ideological currents at play. Which brings us to another story about money and politics, this one out of New Jersey. A lawsuit against the state's teachers union, the NJEA.
Yeah, this one is pretty stunning. It's a lawsuit filed by two teachers, Marie DuPont and Anne-Marie Pachlembo, against their own union.
What are they alleging?
They allege the NJEA spent over $40 million of teachers' mandatory dues money that's supposed to be for collective bargaining, union operations, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Spent it on the failed gubernatorial primary campaign of Sean Spiller, who also happened to be the union president at the time.
$40 million. On a primary campaign. That's an incredible amount of money.
Astronomical. And Spiller finished fifth. The Journal did the math that spending works out to about $450 for every single vote he received.
So where's the alleged illegality? How did the union spend the money?
Well, that's the core of the teacher's lawsuit. They claim the union used these obscure, sort of opaque political front groups, names like Garden State Forward and Working New Jersey, to channel the dues money into the campaign.
Why use front groups?
To get around the rules, allegedly. Yeah. Teachers have to pay union dues. That's mandatory. But they can specifically check a box to opt out of having their money used for political contributions.
Ah, okay.
So the lawsuit argues that by funneling the mandatory dues through these other groups, the union essentially bypassed that voluntary political checkoff and used money for politics that teachers hadn't explicitly authorized.
So Marie DuPont, one of the teachers, she's calling it an illegal breach of contract. Using dues meant for bargaining to basically bankroll the union leadership's political ambitions.
That's the claim. It really highlights this potential conflict between rank-and-file members who want their dues used for workplace issues and union leaders potentially using that huge mandatory war chest for their own political goals.
And this isn't just a civil lawsuit now, is it?
No, the whole situation is apparently under scrutiny from the IRS and the New Jersey State Election Watchdog, over potential misreporting of funds and tax issues as well. It's a big mess.
Yeah, just a couple more quick hits before we move fully international. Higher education is facing some pressure from the administration.
Yeah, the Trump administration rolled out this Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education. The basic idea is to link federal funding eligibility to universities, adopting specific operating principles and maybe even curriculum standards.
How's that going over?
not well with some of the big names, MIT, Penn, USC, Brown.
Yeah.
They've already rejected the proposal.
Why?
Mainly citing concerns about maintaining their academic independence from federal political influence. They see it as government overreach into how universities operate. So it signals a real tension there.
And across the Atlantic, a quick update on the British royals.
Just that the distancing continues for Prince Andrew. He's reportedly agreed to stop using his main title, Duke of York.
This is related to the Jeffrey Epstein fallout.
Yes. It's part of Buckingham Palace's ongoing effort to create more distance due to his friendship with Epstein and the allegations surrounding that, which, of course, he denies. He's also apparently banned from the family Christmas gathering and losing other honorary titles.
Okay, so from those domestic political fights and financial maneuvers, let's pivot now. We need to look at the really high-stakes negotiations and military actions shaping global conflicts, starting with Ukraine.
Right. President Trump seems to be putting a lot of faith in personal diplomacy here. He's planning a summit with President Putin in Budapest soon.
And this comes after his meeting with Ukrainian President Zelensky just last Friday.
Correct. And during that White House meeting, the Journal reports that Trump demurred. He held back on committing long-range Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine.
Tomahawks, those have a really long range, right? Over 1,000 miles.
Exactly. And that range is why this decision is so strategically important.
Why is it so critical for Ukraine?
Because supporters of Ukraine and many military analysts see those Tomahawks as absolutely vital offensive leverage. They could hit targets deep, deep inside Russia command centers, maybe even the factories building drones and missiles that are hitting Ukraine.
So holding them back is a major decision. What's Trump's stated reason?
It seems to be twofold, according to the reporting. One, he's hoping to use the possibility of sending Tomahawks as leverage to push for a diplomatic solution to end the war. Keep that card in his pockets, so to speak.
Okay.
And two, there are apparently genuine concerns within the administration about depleting U.S. stockpiles of these advanced weapons.
And is there any sense that this strategy holding back the Tomahawks is actually having an effect on Russia?
Well, the Journal quotes Andrew Peak, who used to be a senior director on Trump's National Security Council. He argues that Russia has shown in past talks it might be willing to accept certain territorial boundaries, sort of freeze the lines.
Mm-hmm.
And Peak believes the mere threat of Tomahawks, weapons that could strike the Russian heartland, is deeply unsettling for Putin. It might actually force him back to the negotiating table more seriously.
Interesting. Okay, let's shift to the Middle East. President Trump recently announced this historic dawn after getting a truce between Israel and Hamas. But that seems to be hitting some snags already.
Yeah, that fragile peace process is stumbling. And the immediate issue is the return of the bodies of Israeli hostages who died in captivity.
What's the problem there?
Israel was expecting all 28 known bodies back as part of the deal. But so far, Hamas has only returned 11 confirmed bodies. Arab officials apparently told Israel that Hamas knew where at least 6 others were.
Why the delay from Hamas's side?
Well, context here is crucial. The level of destruction in Gaza is just immense. The Journal cites figures saying over 60% of all buildings there have been damaged or destroyed since the war started.
And Hamas is using that as the reason.
That seems to be their claim. They're saying recovering the remaining bodies is incredibly difficult, requiring heavy equipment like bulldozers and excavators.
Which aren't allowed in right now.
Not easily.
Yeah.
Due to Israeli security controls. The International Committee of the Red Cross confirms it's a massive challenge just navigating the rubble. So whether it's a genuine difficulty or a delaying tactic or maybe both, it's definitely threatening the trust that was built to get the truce in the first place.
And things aren't exactly calm on the ground either. There was that incident at the Jordanian Field Hospital complex in Gaza City.
Right, over the weekend. Heavily armed Hamas fighters reportedly seized control of that hospital complex shortly after Israeli forces withdrew from the area.
And that led to fighting.
Yeah, apparently a fierce gun battle erupted between the Hamas fighters and a rival Palestinian group known as the Dogmash Clan.
What's the background there? Why seize a hospital?
Well, local residents and the Israeli military have claimed for a while that Hamas used a building on the hospital grounds as an operations base, maybe even a tunnel site, before the war.
And Hamas denies that.
Of course. Hamas denies using hospitals militarily. They claim their forces were just there to clear out criminal gangs. But it just shows, even during a supposed truce, the internal power struggles and violence are still simmering right below the surface.
Okay, switching to the international legal arena now. A really surprising ruling came out of Poland this week concerning the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage back in 2022.
Yeah, this one is quite something. A Polish court ordered the release of a Ukrainian suspect, Volodymyr Zurovlev. Germany wanted him extradited.
And the Polish court said no. On what grounds?
This is the astonishing part. The judge ruled that blowing up the Nord Stream pipelines was, and this is a quote, a legitimate operation during wartime against an aggressor, meaning Russia.
A legitimate operation? Blowing up civilian infrastructure?
That was the ruling. The judge even explicitly stated that Germany itself was hostile towards Ukraine as it was co-financing the enemy by buying Russian gas.
Wow, how did Germany react?
German prosecutors, who wanted Zurovlev on criminal charges, called the decision shameful. It really highlights a massive legal disagreement about what actions are permissible, even against an aggressor, during wartime.
Meanwhile, some other international incidents. French authorities stopped an assassination plot.
Yes, they foiled a plot targeting Vladimir Osechkin. He's a prominent Russian dissident, head of Gulagu.net, which exposes prison abuse in Russia.
And there was a U.S. military action in the Caribbean.
That's right. The U.S. military conducted a strike on what they described as a suspected drug-carrying, loaded-up submarine.
It's a submarine.
Likely a semi-submersible, common for drug smuggling. The strike apparently resulted in fatalities, but the U.S. did rescue and detain two survivors, giving them medical treatment on the USS Iwo Jima. President Trump called the targets narco-terrorists.
Detaining the survivors, though, that raises some legal questions, doesn't it? The journal seemed to highlight that. It raises huge legal questions. The main issue is, what happens to these survivors now if the U.S. doesn't quickly charge them with a crime in a regular federal court? Yes.
They might try to justify holding them under the laws of war.
The laws of war for suspected drug smugglers.
Exactly. That's the controversial part. Using the law's armed conflict allows for potentially indefinite detention without the usual constitutional rights you get in criminal court. It's the same legal framework used for detainees at Guantanamo Bay.
So applying that to drug runners is a major expansion.
A potentially massive expansion. Legal experts quoted in the piece, like Lori Blank from Emory Law School, are seriously questioning the justification for using that authority here. It blurs the lines between law enforcement and wartime detention in a really significant way.
Okay. And finally, on the global policy front, a big reversal on environmental policy. The global carbon tax for shipping is off.
Yeah, postponed indefinitely, put on ice for at least a year, maybe longer. This was the plan backed by the UN's International Maritime Organization, the IMO.
And why the delay?
Direct, fierce opposition from the Trump administration, basically. They came out swinging against it.
What did they say?
They warned they'd take serious retaliatory measures, things like sanctions, visa restrictions, even potentially blocking ships that complied with the tax from entering U.S. ports. They called it a massive UN tax hike on American consumers that would just drive up prices.
And how was this tax supposed to work? What was the goal?
The idea was pretty straightforward, but the scale was huge. Ship owners would pay a set fee based on their carbon emissions.
And where would that money go?
It was supposed to generate trillions over decades, which would then be reinvested into developing low-carbon fuels and the new technologies needed to decarbonize the entire shipping industry. The industry itself estimated that transition would cost over $3 trillion.
So a massive plan derailed by U.S. opposition.
Essentially, yes. The pressure was intense, and the IMO Secretary General basically had to concede, saying there were no winners and losers after the vote to postpone. It's a stark example of how a single powerful nation's policy can stall global initiatives, even on something like climate change.
Okay, so from those intense global pressures, let's pivot now. We need to look at some massive shifts happening in corporate life, technology, and even personal fortunes. It really paints a picture of the strange fabric of modern society.
It really does. A mix of unbelievable technological ambition, lessons in corporate strategy, and almost unbelievable stories of personal finance. Let's start with AI. And the sheer scale of the infrastructure being built, OpenAI is making huge deals.
With who?
Broadcom, NVIDIA, AMD. They're locking down deals to build custom chips and massive AI supercomputers. The amount of computing power they're committing to is just staggering.
How staggering are we talking?
The journal puts the total commitment at 26 gigawatts of computing capacity. To give you some perspective, that's more electricity than two New York cities need during the summer peak.
Two New York cities, just for OpenAI.
Just for the planned infrastructure. It shows they're not just buying servers, they're trying to control their entire hardware future.
And why the custom chips? Why work with Broadcom specifically, not just rely on NVIDIA who dominates the space?
That's the key strategic insight here. NVIDIA's chips, the really powerful GPUs, are fantastic for training AI models. That's the heavy lifting part, teaching the AI all its knowledge. It takes immense power.
Okay, training is like building the library.
Good analogy. Training is building the library. But OpenAI's big custom chip deals, especially with Broadcom, seem focused more on inference.
Inference being?
Inference is actually using the AI model once it's trained. It's like quickly finding a specific book in that library or getting an answer to a question. That needs to be fast. But more importantly, for profitability, it needs to be cheap to run millions, billions of times.
So custom chips are cheaper for inference.
Potentially much cheaper and more efficient for their specific models. Instead of using a super powerful, versatile NVIDIA chip for every simple query, a custom chip designed just for inference can do that specific job faster and using less energy. It's crucial if they want to make their services profitable at scale.
And there's this technical concept involved called sparsity. How does that fit in?
All right, sparsity is a big part of why custom chips make sense now. Newer AI models are becoming sparse. Think of it like the model develops specialized experts inside itself.
Okay.
So when you ask it a question, only the small, relevant part of the model needs to wake up and process it. You don't need to run the whole massive thing.
Which takes less power.
Exactly. Much less compute power for each query. And chips designed specifically for this sparse activation can be way more efficient than general-purpose GPUs. It's a key technological shift enabling this move towards custom hardware for inference. Fascinating stuff. Okay, let's shift from the cutting edge of AI to a corporate story that looked like a disaster at first, but turned out differently. Walmart's decision a decade ago to raise wages.
Yeah, this is a great case study. Back in 2015, Walmart announced it was raising its starting wage to $9 an hour. This affected nearly 500,000 of their U.S. workers.
And how did Wall Street react at the time?
Brutally. Walmart's stock price plummeted 10% almost immediately. Wiped out something like $21.5 billion in market value in just hours.
Why such a negative reaction? Investors saw it as just throwing money away, basically. They thought it was corporate waste, especially when Walmart was already struggling with slow growth and intense competition from Amazon.
But that's not how the story ended.
Not at all. Fast forward to today, and that very decision is actually studied as a success story at Harvard Business School.
Really? Why?
Well, Walmart CEO Doug McMillon explains that the investment wasn't just about wages. It was about tackling huge problems they had with high employee turnover and really poor morale.
Okay.
And by investing in their workers, making the jobs better, they ultimately got a much better customer experience in their stores.
Mm-hmm.
Cleaner stores, better service, happier employees. And that translated directly into stronger sales growth over time. It helped them compete better against Amazon's convenience.
So the upfront costs that spooked investors actually paid off in the long run by improving the core business.
Exactly. It's a powerful reminder that sometimes investing in your workforce, your human capital, can be a smart long-term strategy, even if Wall Street hates it in the short term.
Okay, now, from a story of corporate foresight to one of, well, alleged personal betrayal on an unbelievable scale, the Hermes $15 billion mystery.
Yeah, this story is just wild. Nicolas Puch, who is an heir to the Hermes luxury goods fortune, is suing the estate of his deceased wealth manager, Eric Freimond.
Freimond died recently.
Yes, by suicide back in July. And Puch is alleging that Freimond basically stripped him of his entire Hermes inheritance, a stake that's now worth over $15 billion.
$15 billion? How could that happen?
The lawsuit paints a picture of incredible manipulation and isolation. Puch apparently trusted Freimond completely. The claim is that Freimond secretly sold off Puch's inherited Hermes shares way back in 2008.
Sold them to who?
Allegedly to Hermes's big rival, LVMH. But all the while, Freimond kept assuring Puch that his massive fortune was safe and sound, still invested in Hermes.
And he isolated him.
Yeah, the suit claims Freimond systematically cut Puch off from friends, family, other advisors, anyone who might question what was happening to maintain total control.
So how did Puch finally find out he'd allegedly been defrauded?
This is the most unbelievable part. It wasn't through lawyers or accountants. Years later, it came down to his handyman's wife, a woman named Maria Paz.
The handyman's wife.
Apparently, Freimond had lied about a much, much smaller transaction, a transfer of about $1.25 million. And Maria Paz somehow found out about that lie and told Petch. That small discrepancy became the thread that unraveled the whole alleged $15 billion deception.
Incredible. So Pech, who was once one of the richest people in Europe,
now says he has basically nothing left except about $1.2 million in real estate. The journal even notes he's been seen flying on budget airlines like EasyJet.
Just a staggering story. It really underscores how vulnerable even vast wealth can be if trust is misplaced.
Absolutely. A cautionary tale on an epic scale.
Okay, let's bring it back down to earth a bit with two quick stories about modern city life, touching on corporations and public spaces. First, the closure of the REI flagship store in Soho, New York City.
Right. REI, the outdoor gear retailer. They're closing that big store, citing slow sales as competitors like Walmart and Amazon eat into the outdoor market.
But the closure is causing an unexpected reaction from New Yorkers.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, but also telling. People aren't just lamenting the loss of the store. They're mourning the loss of what many apparently considered the best free toilet in downtown Manhattan.
The store's bathroom.
Exactly. REI apparently made a point of having a really clean, welcoming, easily accessible bathroom that anyone could use, customer or not. And in a city like New York, which is notoriously short on good public restrooms.
Right.
People really valued it. Its closure is being treated like the loss of a genuinely useful public amenity that was generously provided by a private company. REI spokesperson even said they were surprised by the emotional reactions specifically about the bathroom.
Shows you what people really need sometimes. Okay, and speaking of corporate leaders and city issues, there's the Mark Benioff controversy. The Salesforce CEO had to apologize this week.
He did. A pretty remarkable public apology, actually. It was for comments he'd made calling on President Trump to deploy the National Guard to patrol San Francisco to combat crime.
Benioff has become quite vocal about crime in San Francisco, hasn't he? It seems like a shift for him.
Yeah, he's definitely shifted more rightward on those issues recently. But calling for military intervention in his own city, that crossed the line for many people.
What was the reaction like?
Intense and immediate backlash. His close friend Ron Conway, a major angel investor, resigned from Benioff's foundation board over it, saying he barely recognized him. Political leaders pushed back hard. Employees voiced opposition. It was a firestorm.
So the apology was pretty swift.
Very swift. Clearly prompted by the sheer volume of negative reaction from people close to him and within his own company. Now he seems to be refocusing Salesforce heavily on AI, forging partnerships rather than trying to compete directly with the big AI model makers, especially since Salesforce stock has taken quite a hit this year.
A reminder that even powerful tech CEOs aren't immune to public pressure and stakeholder reaction.
Definitely.
Okay, one last quick story before we try to tie all this together. The impact of data analytics on sports, specifically college football, the game book.
Yeah, this is fascinating. It's an 87-page color-coded guide created by a biomedical engineer named Michael McRoberts. He used to design debt collection strategies.
And now he's advising football coaches.
Over 100 major college football teams are using his game book now. It gives them data-driven advice for those crucial split-second decisions during a game like whether to go for it on fourth down, how to manage the clock, etc.
And what did his data analysis show coaches were doing wrong before?
It exposed just how conservative traditional coaching instincts often were. His data showed that on fourth and one, just needing 1 yard, coaches were choosing to punt the ball away 73% of the time.
Even though the odds of getting that 1 yard are pretty good.
Exactly. The data showed teams actually had a 70 to 80% chance of success if they just went for it. But coaches were punting nearly 3/4 of the time out of risk aversion.
And the game book changed that.
Dramatically. Thanks to the objective data, teams using the book now go for it on fourth and one about 57% of the time. The script is completely flipped, proving how powerful analytics can be in overcoming ingrained habits or gut feelings, even in high-pressure sports.
Okay, so taking a step back from this huge range of stories, this really exhaustive review of the journal, what are the big themes that jump out? It feels like volatility is everywhere.
Absolutely. Volatility is a dominant theme. Economic volatility driven by this overload of information and fear. Political volatility driven by these very specific targeted agendas, whether it's the trade policy carve-outs, maybe acting as a hedge against a court loss, or the DSA's really radical long-term goals.
And there seems to be this constant tension, this struggle between private interests and maybe the broader public good, or at least public expectations.
Yeah, you see that thread running through so many of these stories. You see it in the DSA fighting for narrative control over political discourse. You see it in those New Jersey teachers alleging their mandatory dues were misused for a political campaign.
Even in the seemingly small story about the REI bathroom, a private entity provided a public good and its loss is felt.
Exactly. And then you have the massive players like OpenAI, moving at incredible speed, commanding resources equivalent to multiple cities,
Right.
all to consolidate control over the fundamental hardware of the future, driven by the need for efficiency and ultimately profitability.
So if we try to connect all these dots, maybe the central conflict we're seeing across all these different arenas, finance, politics, tech, even personal fortunes like the Hermes case, is this fight for control. Control in an age where information, money, and ideology are just overwhelming.
Yeah, feels right. And it leads to a final thought, maybe something for you, our listener, to consider. When you see this rapid centralization of control, whether it's political parties controlling narratives, billionaires trying to control economic outcomes, or corporations seeking absolute control over technology, what gets squeezed out in the process? What essential public resources, or maybe social trust, or even vast private fortunes like Cooch's, are being unintentionally, or maybe sometimes deliberately, lost or diminished as that control tightens? That seems like a profound question that runs beneath all these stories from just one weekend's newspaper.